Hello and hi, welcome to another Slice of Sci-Fi. I'm Summer Brooks.
And I'm SF Edwards.
And with us today is director Neil West, whose latest project is Containment, a UK-based thriller that is out in theaters in the United Kingdom right now. It's available, has been available on DVD in the US since August, I believe, but this is a very, very atmospheric and entertaining, just a very, very well done film. And thank you for joining us today, Neil.
Not at all. Pleasure to be here.
So tell us, give us a little overview about what Containment is all about.
So Containment is it's a film about a block of flats in the UK, and Mark, who is our protagonist in the film, wakes up one morning to find out that he's sealed inside his flat, and all communication to the outside world is cut off. And he quickly realizes that actually he's not alone in the whole flat. The entire block is completely sealed in, and people in hazardous materials suits start arriving outside and setting up a kind of base camp, and it kind of goes from there, and lots of mysterious questions get posed. So that's pretty much the setup.
And how did you come across this story and decide to make it?
Well, the premise for the film was something I've had kicking around for a long time, since the sort of late 90s. And then it kind of got shelved for a while. And then after I'd finished my previous film, Undertow, I was trying to sort of figure out a story to do as a debut feature, because that was what I next wanted to do. And I came back to the premise, the initial setup, and started work on it from there. And then after about a year of working on it, David Lemon, the scriptwriter, came on board, and together we kind of shaped the story into much more of the kind of finished product of what we have now. And we spent about a year and a half working together just molding the story and getting it to where we wanted to, so that it would be in a good shape for him to start writing the script. So yeah, it was good. It was a collaborative process.
Okay. I had a chance to watch and review the movie earlier this week, and I found it to be highly enjoyable. When Summer first sent me the information on the screener, my first thought was, wow, this sounds familiar. It almost sounded kind of like the Spanish movie Wreck, and I was pleasantly surprised when it turned out not to be. When it turned out to be just not zombies, but a real disease, and, you know, people freaking out over what kind of sounded like a super flu in the end.
Yeah, no, Wreck was certainly one of the influences. You know, there were a few influences. I mean, films like John Carpenter's The Thing from the 80s, and some literature references like Lord of the Flies. The whole kind of base under siege kind of concept and sort of genre, as it was a big influence. But we were very much keen to take the sort of genre tropes that you would associate with that kind of film and kind of play up to them at first, in order to set up people's expectations, but then turn them on their head a little bit. So, you know, so for example, you know, within Containment, without trying to give too much away, you know, as soon as the setup is in place and the hazmat starts turning up, you immediately start to think, maybe government conspiracy, and, you know, these are the bad guys, the residents are the good guys. But actually, yeah, as the story progresses, that was kind of part of the fun of developing the story to think, okay, where can we take this that will surprise people a bit and work against type? And part of that, I guess, was playing into those genre stereotypes at first, just so that we could then sort of turn them on their head. So, but yeah, that was definitely part of the plan and part of the fun.
Oh, I definitely agree. It was very interesting also to see the whole theme of neighbors not knowing each other, you know, people who've lived next door to each other for, you know, years on end, and it seemed like the only neighbor that the main character knew anything about, that Mark knew anything about, was the old lady character next door. Like, I'm blanking on her name right now.
Enid. Yeah, that's
Enid.
Right.
And like, yeah, he knew about her because she was loud and complained.
Well, it's certainly something I think that comes out of that kind of living in a tower block, that kind of lifestyle. You know, but again, that was something that's fascinating. I mean, certainly in the UK, you know, the tower blocks have such mixed connotations, because you know, much like Enid says in the film, you know, when they were built, sort of post-war, they were homes of the future. There was this ideology that was very positive attached to them, but then gradually over time, they've become associated with kind of social unrest and obviously the sort of council estates where people are housed, they're unemployed. All these kind of negative connotations have been attached, and so you get that kind of double-edged quality to tower blocks, which I think is fascinating, certainly in the class concept. But also, they're amazing just to look at, because you've got, you know, you've got people living above you, beneath you, to the side of you, and I think there is very much that sense of isolation that comes out of that quite often, certainly over here, that people just don't know their neighbours, and it's a sort of alienating but a strange circumstance, particularly when you're literally placed on top of each other.
Yeah, I thought that was very interesting. I mean, you know, my wife and I, we were watching, she comes from a medical background. I remember her looking at me going, this is why we don't live in apartment buildings. They're the perfect vector for diseases like this.
yeah, quite. Yeah, no, absolutely. I guess it's probably the same to some degree with Rec. It's that they're a great location for this kind of genre film, because you do have like the large groups of people in very contained, for want of a better word, environment, you know, and who are sort of placed together, and they can be trapped inside in this kind of a story setup, which allows, in the case of this story, the disease just kind of spread very quickly. But it also, I mean, I guess also for me, the idea of using the apartment block as a location was fun, because you also get this sort of microcosm of society. You get these people from different walks of life, you get different generational gaps, you get different class divides, and you throw them all together, and you do kind of get a little microcosm of society, which is nice, because it makes the story a bit more universal. It makes it about human nature and how these people react to the situation, rather than it just being about, you know, a building full of working class council housed tenants, or, you know, a building, you know, full of middle class tenants, whatever. It gives you that sort of sense of it's almost kind of homogenous kind of society in a very sort of enclosed area, which was fun as well, because it makes it more sort of allegorical, if that makes sense. It makes it more about the themes than about the individuals, even though the characters are obviously very important.
Now, Neil, how did you choose this particular block of flats? Because I've been looking at some of the social media and the comments on YouTube and other places. There were a lot of people who have been excited for this movie to come out, because they're like, they filmed this in my block. I can't wait to see it.
Yeah, there's been a lot, actually. It's been quite surprising. Well, we were very lucky. We were incredibly lucky. We had originally planned to shoot it in London, and we'd looked at every borough within London to try and get permission to shoot in a number of blocks, but it was actually incredibly hard. And we couldn't find what we wanted for a location that would allow us to do what we wanted to do to make the film. And we kind of stumbled across these ones. I mean, they're based in Southampton, which I have a connection to, because it's where I studied film and where I lived for 3 years. And so I just contacted the council there out of nowhere, and they found this block of flats very quickly, and were incredibly helpful in sort of helping us and very encouraging, you know, wanted us to come down to make the film. And we were just so lucky, because it's such a striking block of flats, you know. It was right by the sea, which we weren't expecting. That wasn't in the script, so that was a really interesting added bonus. And they kind of perfectly encapsulate that sort of brutalist architecture that we were looking for the building, you know, something that's concrete and kind of cold and isolating, but also sort of strangely strangely beautiful and striking at the same time. It's kind of interesting. And we filmed in the block while it was completely inhabited, which is probably why there's so many residents tweeting and Facebooking about it, because they were very understanding, but we kind of took over their homes for 3 weeks. So to any of them that might be listening, thank you. Because I'm sure we were a nuisance sometimes.
Now, did filming inside actual active living spaces provide a production challenge for you?
Yeah, it was great for the actors because rather than a studio, they actually get a genuine, authentic space to work within. But it was very difficult from a cinematography point of view, for sure, because I don't know, Arthur, our DOP, I don't know quite how he did it, but the rooms look a lot bigger on the film than they actually were. They was actually pretty tight, tiny, flat, and not so bad once you've just got the cast in, but then when you get the crew in and the equipment, it starts to feel pretty cramped pretty quickly. And actually, the biggest challenge was how we were going to light it, bizarrely, because you know, I wanted as much freedom as possible for the camera. I wanted to be able to sort of turn 360 degrees. I wanted to be able to follow people down corridors and into other rooms. That kind of freedom was really important to me from a direction point of view. And Arthur, amazingly, came up with this scheme in order to light it without actually having a single light on the floor, which was incredible. He lit the whole thing with lights outside of the flat through the window, and just using a handful of source lights that you can actually see in the film, like those little bunnies that light up. And, you know, there's a few camping lamps and things like that that are actually in shot. And amazingly, he managed to light the whole thing just using that, which is also incredible because it's so stylized. So I think that was probably the biggest challenge we had. But thankfully, having a good DOP helped get over that one. I guess the other big challenge, of course, is actually shooting in an actual real location, because you know, we were very lucky to have neighbors who were living there who were very accommodating. But you know, it's very difficult when you're trying to shoot a film and there's people milling around who are living there, and you know, not being able to always control sound and things like that. But we were just very lucky because the residents were very understanding. And yeah, it probably wasn't as difficult as it quite easily could have been.
Now, what was your approach to, I guess, increasing the tension on both the agency people and the residents as the story progressed?
Well, I guess in story terms, in terms of the script, it's just that sense of increased conflict and raising the stakes, you know, as the story progressed and we start to learn more about it, the tensions start to rise through the tempers of certainly of the residents starting to fray, and allegiances starting to splinter a little bit, and people starting to turn on one another. I mean, cinematically and technically, you know, in terms of the direction, there are a number of different things. I mean, it starts out more spacious. Visually, it's a bit more spacious at the beginning, and we do start to tighten up on the shots gradually as we continue into the film, so you get a slightly more claustrophobic sense. And in terms of the look of the film, particularly as it turns from day to night, it becomes the lighting becomes more abstract, and you know, it starts to become a bit more hellish with the reds and the higher contrast. And really the sort of the visual look of it starts to reflect the psychological landscape, you know, as the residents are starting to collapse under the pressure, the building starts to sort of feel like it's closing in on itself in terms of the sort of shadows and the darkness and the light. But I think probably the most important thing was sound design was so important for this film, particularly because it's low budget and independent, and you know, there's so much that you don't see because you're limited just to the point of view of these people in this flat. It was really important to create a sense of the bigger world using the sound design, and there's lots of there's lots of different things that we did with that, sort of cutting out sound at certain points and sort of making the sound more subjective so that you kind of almost go inside characters' heads, and that becomes more intense as the film continues. You know, the sound starts to become slightly more surreal. So I think that was a really important thing to use, particularly as there's so many periods of silence and of characters sort of just talking. One of the things that I talked about with the sound designer a lot was, you guys obviously know Hannibal, the TV series, and there's something they do in Hannibal which is incredible. It's such a great sound design technique, which is often in the scenes when Mads Mikkelsen and that are sort of talking in the room, it's silence, but there's something with the room tone where the room tone is gradually slowly cranked up, and it kind of creates this really loud silence, which is the best way I can think of to describe it. Probably doesn't make any sense, but you get a sense of the room tone, and it creates this incredible sense of discomfort when you're watching it. And there were things like that that we talked about a lot, and little subtle things that you probably wouldn't even notice, but hopefully you'll feel as you're watching the film. And that was really important, and that was also really good fun to play with. So yeah, those are a few of the things that we did, I think, as we sort of carried on.
Well, I definitely would say that the movie did leave you with a sense of you sensed the character's desperation, and at the same time you felt for them. It's like, you know, these people know they're in a bad situation, they don't really know how to get out of it, and when things start to go wrong, they really start to go wrong, which anybody who's been in a bad situation knows it can happen really quick. And then the characters themselves were very real. They felt real. They didn't feel like just a bunch of stereotypes thrown together.
Oh, great. Well, I'm glad that they came across well. That's really good. That's really nice to hear, actually, because it's very much a character piece, and it's so important. I really think the film wouldn't work if you didn't really buy into this group and what they're experiencing as they're experiencing it. I mean, David and I spent a lot of time trying to figure out the individual characters' dilemmas and their story arcs, and I spent a lot of time in the sort of limited rehearsal time I had working with each individual actor to try and sort of work out a backstory for the characters and where they came from, and sort of just to really define them. Because I think as long as the actors have a very defined idea of what the characters are, then that communicates, you know, to the audience in ways that are very subtle that you wouldn't even be able to pinpoint, that it becomes believable, and their sort of objectives and drives become very real because they sort of inhabit the role. And I mean, I was very lucky to have such a great group of actors who were able to inhabit this group. But yeah, it was definitely meant to be, you know, real people that you could identify with. And I think for me, part of the fun of the story was that if you identify with this group of people, when everything does start to go wrong and they start to make these terrible, horrible choices sometimes, then by empathizing with them, it kind of places the audience in that kind of what-if situation of thinking, well, what would I do in this situation? And, you know, if I like Mark, or if I, you know, relate to Sally or whoever, and they make this terrible choice, then I always thought it'd be quite fascinating as an audience perspective to think, oh, you know, would I make that choice? And what does that say? What does that say about me? You know, and that whole question of who we are under the surface, and when we're put under sort of pressured circumstances, you know, if we lose the sort of facade of, you know, the safety of sort of civilization, and we sort of start resorting to survival sort of tactics, then would it be a surprise to us to find out that we may make some fairly questionable choices? That was all kind of it's quite a dark area, but it was quite a fun area to explore.
Yeah, I think part of what makes it easier to connect to characters that feel real is you see a variety of people reacting very differently to the same situation because of their nature, because of their training, because of their history, and that adds a level of depth to a good story.
Yeah, absolutely. I think definitely having that that range is so important. And actually, that so much of that is down to David. I mean, David's writing was just so brilliant, and also just in terms of the story, you know, because when I initially met David, the story was about one character trapped in his flat, and there were other characters and other neighbours, but he was communicating with them through the wall and through vents in the wall and things like that. So he was never in direct physical contact with them. And it was David that actually said, you know, I think we need to get a group of people together into the same room because that will make it more dynamic and it will create more conflict. And obviously it allows you to explore more characters. And I think what you're saying is absolutely right, and that kind of choice that David pushed was absolutely right, because by having that group there who, like you said, are, you know, reacting all sorts of different ways because of their backgrounds and what they think is the right way to deal with it, it makes it feel more real and makes it much more chaotic as well, and I think adds to the sort of tension. But yeah, that was definitely something that David really brought to the table, which was a huge benefit, I think, for the story.
Well,
the actors were so great with it. You know, they brought loads of stuff that neither David nor I had foreseen. You know, there were so many lovely little moments that they sort of just brought to it because they knew the characters, which was great fun.
Well, I think it's kind of funny because one of my favorite authors is Robert E. Howard, and I think one of his quotes is, "Barbarism is the natural state of mankind. Civilization is unnatural. It is a whim of circumstance, and barbarism must always ultimately triumph." And I love seeing, and talk about your pessimistic outlooks there.
Yeah.
But I love seeing stories that explore that slow breakdown of what we consider to be civilization, with instead of seeing what happens after the apocalypse, after civilization has crumbled and dissolved, watching what happens as the society is crumbling, or part of society is crumbling, or just one little neighborhood is falling apart, mm-hmm. is fascinating to me, because lots of different people have a different approach to how that might progress. And you've put together a very interesting little slice of life in terms of just watching that happen for a certain group of people.
Well, thank you. Yeah, no, that's really nice to... That's really nice to hear. That's a great quote as well. That's a great quote. But I completely agree with that. I mean, it's funny actually, just you saying that, because it just reminded me of someone that was helped us with some of the early poster design for the film. I remember him asking, asking me about the film, and he said, "Oh, it's like a kind of post-apocalyptic film," and I said, I remember, I don't know why it just came out, but I remember saying to him, no, it's not a post-apocalyptic, it's a pre-apocalyptic film. And that was kind of sort of stuck as the way to sort of define it, because it wasn't real. It kind of has a post-apocalyptic feel, but it's sort of seeing the, like you said, seeing the moment where everything dissolves rather than dealing with the aftermath, which is fascinating. You know, it is such a fascinating, because of human nature and how people react to it. For me, like I said, Lord of the Flies was one of the big influences, and for me the thing that's most fascinating about Lord of the Flies is whenever someone reads it for the first time, they're always horrified and think, how could children do this? And it's that it's like that quote, that notion of like, well, you know, we are, and you know, it is a very pessimistic perspective, but we are fundamentally still animals like everything else. And you know, this group of children on the island that have to survive, and so they fall back on that. But it's fascinating to look at, because it is that notion that we live in a civilized society, so people just get it into their heads and think, oh, no, we wouldn't do anything like that. Mm-hmm. No, we wouldn't do that. People are better than that. But actually, take everything away and you think, well, it's kind of interesting. See where we go.
Yeah, I think if you take a look at all of these stories of bullying in high schools, you see a parallel between the packs of wild animals driving out the unwanted members of their pack, and the pack of wild children driving out the kids who they think don't belong when, you know, it's high school. Yeah. Everybody doesn't belong.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
Well, thank you for your time today talking about Containment. This is really a really interesting film. Literally, it's not what you expect. If you expect a zombie movie, it's not. And it's just a compelling, and like you said, the claustrophobia builds up the tension. It's very, very well written story, well shot story, and thank you for making it.
Well, thank you for having me on the show to talk about it. It's been great fun to chat about it.
Now, where can people find it? I know it's in theaters right now in the UK. It's available on home video and on demand in the US. Is there any website where people can check out?
Well, I'm just trying to think, actually, because I'm not sure. I would give you the main Containment website, which is Containment Film. I think containment-film.com. But I'm not sure if it's got details on there of everywhere that's available. It's definitely available on, I mean, in the States, it's definitely available on iTunes and other VOD platforms. It's also available on a fairly new platform, I think, called We Are Colony, which is a really interesting one because it's as a platform, it's kind of about not just the film, but the experience of making the film. So I think when you buy the film, you buy a package, you get the film, you get the script, and you get a making of film that was made during the making of the film, which has got all this behind the scenes footage, which is really interesting. So I know that you can get that from there, and that's all very reasonable. But yes, my producers are going to kill me, but I can't remember all of the other platforms. Definitely iTunes, and I think possibly Virgin as well, actually. Yes, I can't remember. And you can get the DVD in the States now. You can buy it in places like Walmart and places like that. So there's quite a few different ways you can get hold of it, definitely.
Now, does the DVD include all those extras that We Are Colony has?
I'm not entirely sure whether it's got the making of. It has got, and I think they've got this on the DVD in the States. We did a commentary, myself and the writer and the producers, about the films, which is a DVD commentary, which was really good fun and had some interesting nuggets of information. And I'm pretty sure that's on the DVD. I can't be 100%, but I'm pretty sure it is. But I think the making of the things, I think, are only exclusive to We Are Colony. But it's definitely worth checking out We Are Colony because it's a really interesting new platform, just because it tries to give you more than the film. It tries to give you sort of much more inclusive sort of experience. And I think for a good price, I think it's about the same price as the DVD. So,
cool.
So hopefully that's given people a few places to have a look at.
Well, I will just do a little bit more research to find the links to direct everybody to the right places.
Thank you. That would be great.
Again, thank you so much for joining us today.
No, thank you for having me. Again, like I said, it's been really great. And I'm really glad that you guys liked it. And I hope that that everyone over there enjoys it.
Yeah, thank you. And it's always nice to see an actually good movie coming out of anywhere that's gripping, that engages you, has real characters, and you can actually feel for their plight and say, I'm glad I'm
well,
not
thank
now.
You. Thank you. Yeah, well, thank you very much for that. I really appreciate that. It's you know, ultimately, when you make a film, it's just really nice to hear that people enjoy it, cool. People engage with it. That's fundamentally what it comes down to. And I look forward to reading the review. I think that'll be great.
Excellent. Well, the movie is Containment. We will have links to that and all the different places you can find it. Come to the website and check out Sean's review. And we will be back with more Slice of Sci-Fi right after this.
Slice of Sci-Fi. tuning into Sci-Fi TV. Hey, everybody, welcome back. I'm Brent Barrett.
I'm Kevin Batchelder.
I'm Wendy Hembrock.
The Viewer's Guide to Genre Television.
Welcome, everyone, to a special Supernatural-focused bonus
Hello, everyone,
show.
And welcome to The Fae Files,
a family of podcasts for the genre-loving television viewer.
Welcome to Saturday B Movie Reel.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the study
welcome
group.
Welcome to the top genre characters of all time countdown.
And tonight, we're going to be talking about Game of Thrones.
Find us at tuningintosci-fi-tv.com.
Hello and hi, welcome to more Slice of Sci-Fi. I'm Summer Brooks.
I'm SF Edwards.
And our special guest today is director, producer, film creator, crazy idea implementer, Khalil Sullins, who has a new indie film out called Listening. It's a sci-fi thriller that we will let Khalil tell us all about. Welcome to the show, Khalil.
Yeah, thanks so much. Thanks for having me.
Now, give our listeners a little little background, a little summary about what Listening is all about.
So Listening's a tech thriller about three broke grad students who invent mind reading technology. They think it's going to solve all their problems, but of course kind of does just the opposite. Sort of wreaks havoc in their personal lives and then falls into the wrong hands. There's a covert government agency working on similar technology. And by the end, these best friends sort of turn into enemies, fighting over, you know, not only the fate of their technology, but potentially the future of human free will itself.
Now, how did you get involved with this project? What was the driving force where you said, I need to get this made?
I went to film school. There's a school called Art Center College of Design in Pasadena, which is a great film school. And when I was in school, you know, I think the films I was seeing there all looked and sounded great, but I felt like they were sort of failing on a script level. So I initially wanted to be a director, but I really started focusing on screenwriting. And so after I graduated, I wrote 7 or 8 scripts, I guess, before I felt like I had one that was really, you know, worth investing, you know, three or four years of my life into. And, you know, it really just needed to be made. I wrote the script myself. The initial seed of an idea was, what if someone invented telepathy? And from there, I sort of did a bunch of research into actually how you might go about doing that. The film's a hard sci-fi film, meaning all the science and technology you see in the film either actually currently exists or is theoretically possible. And then I also wanted to examine our relationship with communication technology in general and how every day we're given new ways to put our thoughts and feelings out there into the world faster than ever before, but it doesn't necessarily always make us better communicators on a human level. So there's some irony in the fact that, you know, David, the main character, invents the latest, greatest form of communication and telepathy, but he doesn't know how to properly communicate with his wife or daughter or his best friend. So these relationships sort of crumble.
Okay, I had watched the movie, and I found it fairly interesting. The concepts itself were pretty well put together. I especially found that the equipment you used actually was fairly spot on for the EEG equipment. I have a child who has neurological disorders, so I see that stuff all the time. And mm-hmm. I was like, oh, they actually got the EEG hood right, whereas most of these things, they tend to forget how you put those on correctly.
Totally. Yeah, we sort of, you know, had to make our own makeshift little EEG net, but our prop designer, production design team did a good job with that, I thought.
On top of that, I thought that the camera work, especially when they actually do start doing the telepathy was actually fairly interesting. It reminded me a lot of Alfred Bester's, Summer, can you remind me the name of the book? His telepath look.
The Demolished Man?
I think that's it. Wherein it was no longer a static camera angle, just it kept jumping around as they were thinking of different things while they were trying to think and communicate with one another, which really kind of said, oh, yeah, that's how my brain works.
Right, totally, yeah. So because the movie sort of has this hard sci-fi tone, I really didn't want it to jump into the realm of fantasy by, you know, inventing, you know, crazy fantasy images of what it might look like when you go inside the mind. So, we sort of decided to do it through a filming technique, which we sort of dubbed it Flickr 3D, which it's common in still photography. They call it stereoscopic photography, where you sort of take two pictures from about eye distance apart, and then you flicker back and forth between those two images. And for some people, it creates a sense of depth perception as though they're seeing a 3D image. But even if it doesn't create that sense for you, like, yeah, it gives almost this cubist element to the inside of the mind thing, sequences. Like you're saying, like you could be thinking multiple things at once, you know, a million thoughts a second are flying through your head. And so even visually, you're sort of seeing the same subject from multiple angles. So that paired with, you know, sound design and music, I think allowed us to feel like we're entering a mind space, a different world, while still, you know, maintaining that sort of hard sci-fi tone.
Mm-hmm. Well, and especially when David links with his wife and the mind wandered a little bit there, it did get into, like you said, ended up getting into a bit of trouble.
Right. Yeah, totally. And that's the whole idea behind the film, right? It's like, would you actually want someone plugging into your head and reading your thoughts, you know? Do you really want, like, we all have filters in our brains, right? We don't do and say everything that we think. You don't, you know, say every little thought that pops into your head. But, you know, the whole movie's kind of a metaphor for, you know, social media today. You could go online to any news article or any YouTube video and read, you know, the comment threads underneath, and you'll get a lot of unfiltered thoughts out there and a lot of negativity oftentimes. And so, yeah, telepathy was kind of a way for me to, like, metaphorically examine, you know, this in a very real way, you know, like, oh, yeah, maybe we should be thinking before we type whatever we're about to send via, you know, technology, and how we feel safe behind our technology. But really, this is affecting the world and, you know, our relationships with people around us. And, yeah.
And I was always kind of curious, especially like the character of Ryan's motivations in the movie. He, when they first brought in Sharon, his
Jordan.
No, Jordan. His
right.
comment was, yeah, you know, the military applications are obvious, and they did make a reference to things like Facebook. But then his motivations towards the end, and they shifted pretty radically. And he never really explained some of his motivations more clearly, I guess.
Yeah, there's a big turning point in the film, which I don't really want to give away fully, I guess. But yeah, there's a big turning point in the film where Ryan sort of shifts a little bit and goes off the deep end. Yeah, for me, you know, he's Ryan. From both the characters, David and Ryan, you know, have like start out with pretty high stakes from the beginning. You know, David's like facing addiction, and you know, is trying to, you know, fix his broken marriage, and Ryan lives with his grandmother, who you know, is sick and also presumably maybe has some sort of communication disorder herself. You know, she never speaks in the film, and so yeah, Ryan, they're both sort of trying to do the right thing, but there's this sub theme in the film of, like, you know, the characters are never fully able to line up doing the right thing for the right reasons, you know, having good intentions and good actions. They might get one of those right, but then if you don't get them both right, it sort of leads to tragic consequences. And yeah, so for Ryan, I think, you know, I think there's a couple slips there, you know, where Ryan goes off the deep end, but then by the very end of the film, I think, you know, Ryan is actually making some more interesting points, and David's the one who sort of becomes the terrorist in some ways, you know, like he's the one. Anyways, yeah, like there's a dynamic in lots of movies that's interesting to me. Like you could watch a James Bond movie, right? And James Bond will kill 100 people throughout the film, but you're still rooting and cheering for him. But technically, James Bond's kind of a mass murderer in some ways, you know? So that dynamic's always been kind of interesting to me. So I tried to create these two characters that sort of lived in the gray area, that one wasn't, like, evil and one was good, but you sort of make arguments either way for their, you know, philosophies.
Well, I also like the way that the technology progressed as they were working with it, and they were, you know, getting different avenues of equipment.
But
I did find it funny when they were borrowing equipment from the school lab, and I'm like, hey, I had that computer at my work.
Yeah, that was something, yeah, I wanted the technology to continually advance, because that's how the world is, right? You know, every day we have a new app on our phone or a new phone altogether, you know. A lot of movies, you know, you sort of just quickly set up what the technology is, what the rules are, and that's it, you go. But, yeah, we sort of had the technology evolve as the film did, as the story progressed, and the filmmaking techniques, too, you know, even behind the scenes, sort of like, you know, at the beginning, the camera's all handheld and whatnot in the garage, but then as the technology gets more slick and we're in these CIA labs at the end, so does the filmmaking style, too. You know, you start getting more slick dolly movements and robotic camera movements. So, yeah, I think that evolution was important to us. And we did it with sound design, too. Actually, we had a lot of fun with sound design and how, like, the clunkiness and what you hear, you know, at the beginning, there's a lot more noise and just, like, like, what was important to us is it's a movie about communication, but it's a movie about the things that get in the way of communicating. So we tried to throw as much noise as we could in there, actually, with sound design. But that evolves, too, as the movie progresses.
Now, I also noticed, especially in the early part of the film, there was a lot of filter usage. Were the filters intended to, as part of the storytelling medium, is like, you know, were individual colors meant to represent individual things going on?
Yeah, totally. Yeah. So, you know, I really try to, one, you know, extreme color palettes are a common device in sci-fi film. You know, oftentimes good sci-fi films will use extreme color palettes to help transport the audience to a different world. And yeah, for me, I wanted to use every tool at my disposal. And I come from a visual arts background, you know, I'm a painter and sculptor and stuff. So color's always been interesting to me. I was trying to think, how do you tell the story with color? And so visually, the film is told from David's point of view. So the main character, David, he's a computer programmer. And we thought of him as someone who compartmentalizes his life. And so we created these five visual worlds, we called them. And each one is sort of a psychological space. There's a psychological logic to the color scheme. And each of these worlds has a unique color scheme and a unique method of camera movement. So, yeah, for instance, in the garage world, you have these lively greens and kinetic handheld camera movement, but also looks kind of like a horror movie because it's dangerous what they're doing. But this is where David feels alive, and he's inventing and in his element. And then you can contrast that to, like, his home world. And there the camera never moves, and you have these lifeless violets and silhouettes. And that reflects his relationship with his wife and his daughter and his broken marriage in general. And then you have, like, the outside world, which are these bright yellows with lots of lens flares and overexposed sort of feeling. And that I wanted to feel like, you know, David's life, he spends most of his life, you know, in this dark garage programming. And when he steps outside, it's a bit uncomfortable and paranoid. And I wanted to feel like when you see a matinee movie and you step outside and the sun sort of hurts your eyes, you know, that's sort of David's life. And there the camera movement's voyeuristic with long lenses, and so there's this sort of paranoid feeling like someone's always watching. And on through the film, yeah, there's sort of a logic like that. The CIA world's a dark play on the American flag, red, white, and blue. And the jungle world is natural hues and meditative camera movement.
Now, from a production standpoint, were there any elements in the original script that you had written that you actually couldn't film or didn't have time to film or didn't have the budget to film?
Actually, sort of the opposite. there's a lot that ended up on the cutting room floor, which Yeah, I think, I mean, this was a unique indie film in that, you know, we had over 35 locations around the globe, you know, in Los Angeles, Washington, D.C., and Cambodia. So it wasn't engineered as sort of your micro-budget indie film. But, yeah, some of even our biggest days, shoot days, are either barely in the final film or aren't there, you know. You know, one, this is my first feature film, and so there's some fear, you know, maybe you'll never make another one. So you try to cram every idea you can into there. And then in the editing room, I felt like I learned a whole lot about screenwriting and how kind of every time we cut away from the A story, which is, you know, David and Ryan and this sort of crumbling relationship, the forward momentum would just die, you know. So, yeah, there were deeper subplots between Melanie and Jordan, for instance, and Ryan and Jordan's love story was a little more developed, and there was even a much bigger subplot with David and his daughter, where his daughter, even by the end of the film, David's daughter had grown up, and David sort of in prison and telling this whole story to her years later, which all of which isn't in the final film. Maybe we'll do a special DVD release or Blu-ray release with some cut scenes at some point, but because they're great scenes, but you know, it's you got to keep the pace up, I guess, when you're telling a sci-fi thriller.
Yeah, it sounds like you're gonna need an entire extra disc just for the deleted scenes.
Yeah, yeah. I want to know what happened with the volcano.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that volcano. Which the volcano is like, it's barely out of focus in one shot, you know, finally finished in the background at Melanie's mom's house. I'm like, there it is, there's a volcano, but yeah, you never really fully see it.
Well, hopefully we will get a special director's cut DVD or extras DVD with, I'm hoping, an extensive commentary track by you.
Yeah, I'd love to do a commentary track. Yeah, hopefully we do that at some point. With maybe some of the actors, and yeah, maybe our cinematographer Blake McClurry did an amazing job too. It'd be really fun to do a commentary track.
So this movie is on demand right now. Is there anywhere else they can catch it?
So it comes out today theatrically in about a dozen cities, L.A., New York, San Francisco, San Diego, Cleveland, Columbus, Atlanta. You can find all the cities that you can watch in theaters at listeningmovie.com. And it's also available on demand for rent and purchase on every major cable provider and iTunes and every digital platform online, Google Play, Amazon, PlayStation, Xbox, basically anywhere you can rent or buy a movie. We're out today. Today's our big launch day.
And that's, today is September 11th, the Friday, where every Friday seems to be 5 major releases and 200 indie releases. How do people find the time to watch all these interesting, good films? But yours is out there for people to check out. Is there a good place to give you feedback for the movie? Is listeningmovie.com the place to go for that?
You can rate the film on IMDb and on iTunes. You can rate the film anywhere, I guess. You can also, we're on social media, so you can, you know, tag us. We're on Instagram and Twitter at Listening Movie, and we're on facebook.com/listeningmovie. So yeah, definitely reach out to us, tell us what you think, if you love it, hate it, you know, if you want your spouse to be plugging into your brain or you'd never want that, let us know what you think on social media.
And everybody get in your votes for a special edition DVD with all the deleted scenes and the extra commentary.
Yeah, totally. I think we're also actually going to start a Tug campaign. If people are familiar with Tug, if people want a screening in their city, they can sort of vote for it on that website. And if they pre-sell enough tickets, then it'll come to theaters in their city as well.
Excellent. We will definitely make sure to link to that. Well, thank you for your time today, Khalil.
Well, thank you. It's great talking to you guys.
And thank you for making an interesting sci-fi thriller that showcases a little bit of special production value with getting the, I guess, the answer, asking the questions that science fiction movies have always asked. It's like, what happens when? What if? So you've given us a good question and a good answer, and can't wait to see more from you later.
Thanks so much. Thank you.
Thank you as well.
And we'll be back with more Slice of Sci-Fi right after this.
Hello, audience. Listen to your podcast player. Now back to me. Now back to your podcast player. Now back to me. Sadly, it isn't me. But if it stopped playing pop music and switched to the Dragon Reel podcast, it could sound like me. Look down. Back up. Where are you? You're in a movie theater with the podcast your podcast player could sound like. What's on the screen? I downloaded it. It's a swashbuckler with a magic rapier. Look again. The swashbuckler is now an evil sorceress. Anything is possible when you listen to the Dragon Reel podcast and not music. I'm on a unicorn.
Listen to Dragon Reel, the fantasy film podcast at dragonreel.com, or subscribe on iTunes or wherever great podcasts are found.
You're home from the comic book store with your favorite titles. Wouldn't they read better while listening to Krypton Radio?
Welcome back to more Slice of Sci-Fi. I'm Summer Brooks.
And I'm SF Edwards.
And indie movies, I love finding indie movies that are surprising and entertaining. And it looks like we got, you got to experience a good one and a great one with these two films.
I would go along with that. And, you know, my wife and I, we actually do kind of search out the indie films a little bit more lately because they are more interesting. They tend to be better written. And just generally, in a lot of ways, while the budget isn't there of, like, you know, your big Hollywood blockbusters, it's original stories again, which are, I don't know, I think that's the reason we watch movies is for original stories. Maybe I'm weird that way.
No, I mean, you do get tired of reading or seeing the same story over and over and over again. I think that's, you know, from a marketing standpoint, I understand Hollywood wanting to retell the same successful movies. I mean, when they get to the point of rebooting a movie every 10 years because a new generation of people hasn't seen it yet, I'm going to scream.
Oh.
I really am going to scream because at one point, I'm going to say this might have been 4 or 5 years ago. At one point, it looked like they were planning to remake every single movie I grew up with in the 80s. Yeah. And my brain just kind of melted. I went, wait, what? I've seen those. I own a couple of those on DVD. What are you doing to me? Why are you being so lazy?
Oh, yeah, and especially when the movie is already perfect as it is. I mean, I did a review on the Terminator sequel, reboot, whatever you want to call it, and I was overly critical on that one, I'll say, because honestly, it was a bad movie.
A lot of people thought that was a bad movie.
You know, Terminator is still, in my opinion, it's a perfect movie in a lot of ways. And if you're sitting down, I had just read a thing right before this, they're remaking Highlander.
The movie or the TV series?
Movie.
Oh, dear goodness.
But I will say that they could bring something interesting into it with the whole social media aspect. How much harder would it be for a immortal to hide in the age of social media?
Because you have people with videos, you have surveillance cameras. You're not going to be able to hide as easily as you could 20 years ago.
Exactly. And then you have, like, you know, like that whole, those memes going on of, look, I found a picture of, you know, whatever celebrity, Nicolas Cage from World War II or from Civil War. You know, it's like,
yeah, there are so many photographic archives that are digitally searchable now. That, ooh, that could be.
And if they take that route, I'll be less upset. I'm not guaranteeing I'm going to be happy, but
It literally, with the reboots and the remakes, it really does matter to the approach. Like, back in the day, Battlestar Galactica was my thing. The original Battlestar Galactica was my first science fiction, first big science fiction media event. And the only reason was because for some reason back then, my mom wouldn't let me see Star Wars. Star Wars came out in May of 77. I didn't actually see it in the theaters until October 78. And by then, Battlestar Galactica had already aired. So I had already gotten hooked on Battlestar Galactica. I saw similarities, but I could tell they weren't the same story. You know, it was just, you know, two different groups of people battling for their lives out in space. And so when the reboot of Battlestar Galactica came along, I was hopeful, because technology's improved, I can get better CGI on the spaceships, I can get better battles, and oh yeah, they did. The Star Wars prequel, I waited to see what was going to happen. I'm one of the few people who enjoyed Phantom Menace for what it was. Phantom Menace was a documentary about the Machiavellian machinations of Palpatine. When you look at that, as that entire movie is a Palpatine long con and nothing else, you have to sit back and go, dude, golf clap. Machiavelli would be proud. Yeah. The other two movies in the prequel series, I cannot give a pass to. I'm sorry. So, yeah, it depends on how I feel about the original property before I debate on whether or not I could take a reboot. Like, they keep talking about the reboot of Goonies, and I have to say, why?
It would never work today.
Yeah, I'm like, why? Seriously, why Goonies? Why not just make it about a different bunch of kids hunting for a different treasure for a different reason?
The closest to a Goonies reboot would have been what is that movie my wife took the kids to that everybody said was an E.T. reboot, where they find the little robot in the...
Oh, Earth to Echo?
Earth to Echo. She's like, that movie is very much E.T. meets Goonies in a modern setting.
Huh, okay. And that movie kind of got panned.
Yeah, unfortunately, we liked it.
Hmm, interesting.
My kids loved it. They thought it was fantastic. Like, wow, that's actually... Because it involved so many of the things they were into. Whereas I think Goonies now just isn't going to work because of the social media aspect of things. Kids don't go really on adventures anymore.
That's true. I mean, literally, unless they're teenagers learning how to LARP, that it doesn't happen.
Or they're scouts out there scouting.
And speaking of scouts, there is a movie coming out later this year called Scouts vs. Zombies.
I think I saw a preview for that. It looks twisted funny. You know?
So yeah, somebody went with, well, the Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts are the only kids that go outside anymore and do stuff with the real world. Let's go there. Okay, the next movie we need a bunch of 4-H kids who stumble across cattle mutilations and then try to investigate that.
If there's a property about kids on them doing a crazy adventure you want to reboot,
mm-hmm.
or, you know, Lord of the Flies.
Ooh.
Lord of the Flies with modern kids would be absolutely insane, because the first thing that they're all going to freak out about is, I can't play, I can't get on Facebook.
There you go. Oh, there you go. Lord of the Flies crossed with Lost.
Yeah.
There you go. All right, I want a finder's fee if anybody makes that. Doesn't have to be much, just a little bit, just, you know, a little taste.
I'll write it.
Go for it. Oh my goodness. But yeah, I was, I think you had fallen offline when Neil and I started talking about the pre-apocalyptic, post-apocalyptic thing.
Yeah, unfortunately.
And I was telling him, like, how the the premise of watching a supposedly civilized group of people lose it, just literally shed all veneer of civilization and fall into what becomes the apocalyptic, the post-apocalyptic scenario, is that Robert E. Howard had a great quote. He said, "Barbarism is the natural state of mankind. Civilization is unnatural. It is a whim of circumstance. And barbarism must always ultimately triumph."
Yeah, I can see that.
And even though I think that's a little too pessimistic, unfortunately, it has played out as being way accurate. We've seen it in history repeated over and over and over again, where people lose the creature comforts they've become used to, and they turn into Bane. For lack of a better word. Some of them go Joker, and you're going to have a handful of people who are going to go Deadpool, manage to keep their sense of humor, but still just go batshit.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. So what is your recommendation for people to go check out these two indie movies and others? Where do you go looking for indie movies?
Well, honestly, I mean, we don't get to go out to see a whole lot of these movies anymore with all the kids and stuff. We find a lot of them on Netflix. Netflix is actually filled with a lot of indie movies, and sometimes we're just looking for something bad. Sometimes we're looking for something good. But I found some ones on there. I have found ones on there. In terms of these ones, I would say go ahead and check them out. Listening is interesting. It's a little more interesting now that I've actually, you know, we had the interview with the director and I see some of the things he was doing with it. Honestly, until the midpoint of the movie, I was about ready to sit there and I was getting to the point of, I think I'm going to turn this off, because I wasn't that engaged with it. But once they got to the midpoint, things ramped up. I was actually like, okay, now it's actually gotten interesting. Now it kind of fits. But then I'm one of those guys that I had a friend walk out of The Sixth Sense.
Oh, wow.
Five minutes before the movie ended.
5 minutes? They lasted that long and couldn't wait 5 more minutes?
Yeah, they could not wait, and they just finally got up and left. And we walked out of the theater, and he was just like, well, you know, that stunk. And we're like, no, you have to go back and watch the last 5 minutes of this movie. And, you know, we ended up buying him a ticket to do it, and he walked out and was going, okay, you're in it, watch it. You know? And I was like, okay, maybe this movie's going to do something to surprise me. And it did a bit. I would say it's nothing super groundbreaking or, you know, nothing that's really going to sit there and sit with you forever and say, oh, this was a great movie, I'm going to love it forever. It's definitely worth it to sit through the whole thing and get to when it gets good. If the beginning had been better, I would have given it, you know, a better rating. In terms of containment was just pleasantly surprising from the get-go. And when it didn't turn into zombies in an apartment block, I was like, wow, thank you for not going there, but really showing how scared people would get in that kind of situation with not knowing what's going on,
mm-hmm.
no idea of how to escape it. And even once you get to a point when maybe you can escape, just how much stuff is degraded. You're like, this is a world I even want to live in anymore, you know?
Yeah. Is escaping even the right thing to do, I think, is one of the questions that came up.
Yeah, exactly. Especially given that this is a contagion and they're having such problems containing it.
Mm-hmm. I know people who do emergency management. I'm like, what do you do when the policy says don't divulge information? I mean, having no information is going to make people panic faster.
Exactly.
Seriously. Just people want to know. You cut off their cell phone signal. You cut off their internet. People are literally going to go native that much faster.
And honestly, I think that's one of the characters they could have added to it, is they could have added like a computer geek who was just completely... like, I can't check Facebook, and just like losing their mind
mm-hmm.
And that's one of the things my wife and I have always discussed. You know, if things were to go bad, who's the first people to go? It's the people who can't live without their Facebook feed.
The people who can't drive around town without checking their GPS on their phone.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, literally, you wanna keep the food to yourself? Give somebody wrong directions. Oh, that is just mean. I'm sorry I said it, but it's funny. There you go. Use it in the movie. I would like to hear from people where they find their indie movies. I've been doing a lot of stuff with Netflix. There was a movie called Parallels that was surprisingly very good. I'm still waiting to hear if there's going to be another movie or if that actually... Because that was supposed to be the pilot to a series.
Yeah, if that turns into a series, I would be very interested.
I was working the guys, the PR guys at Fox Digital gave me an advanced screener of it before it actually hit Netflix. And I said, is this supposed to be a series or is there like a sequel already in the works? He said, this is supposed to be the pilot for a series. As soon as we get more information on the series, we'll let you know. It's been almost 6 months.
Yeah, I'm not holding out too much hope. It was good, though.
It got very, very surprisingly good in that last half hour, especially. I was like, Whoa, wait, I need, wait, huh? More, please, more.
I would definitely agree with that one.
And everybody chime in. Chime in on Twitter, chime in on the website. Just let us know what little indie gem did you find? Science fiction, horror, paranormal, what have you. Share. We want to check out good entertainment that isn't a reboot.
And I will say I found another one recently. It's on Netflix right now called Infini.
I think I saw that.
Yeah, and that was actually pretty fun.
Oh, okay.
It was kind of doomish in a way.
Mm-hmm.
And it is one of those ones that as it gets towards the end, you're kind of like, oh, do I really want to sit through this? Do it. Do sit to the end and see what happens. What happens at the end is somewhat surprising. And it's one of those movies that you sit down and you think about it, you're going, okay, not exactly the way I would have done it, but good. I can see the characters saying to do a certain... I kept having a certain Aliens quote going through my head at one point. but it was quite good. And nothing that's like... It's not going to win any Oscars. It's probably not going to get a whole lot of buzz out there. But it was good. And I would definitely say it's something worth checking out.
Cool. Well, we'll add that to the list. Either way, thank you, Sean, for joining the show today to talk to our indie directors and to talk about indie movies in general.
Oh, I'm an indie author, so we're in the same kind of boat there.
Cool. We will continue looking for more independently produced projects, bringing them to you. If you have something that was cool, let us know, because like I said, we want to check out more good stories, and word of mouth is the absolute best marketing there is, right?
It is. Word of mouth and good reviews.
Cool. And that will do it for this episode of Slice of Sci-Fi. If you have any questions or comments, call them in. That number is 602-635-6976. Again, 602-635-6976. Or you can just record a message yourself and email that in to summer@sliceofscifi.com. If you're enjoying the show, leave a review for us on iTunes. Go to the iTunes store, search on Slice of Sci-Fi, you'll find us there. Leave us a review. Tell us what we're doing right, tell us what we're doing wrong. Let other people know that you listen to the show and you enjoy it and they should check it out too. You can also check us out on Twitter, @SliceofSciFi. We're over on Google Plus, plus.google.com, plus Slice of Sci-Fi, I think is how that's worded. There's a link on the website. Click it. We're also on Facebook. And, of course, the website is sliceofscifi.com. We also have itscomicbookday.com, which has a lot of commentary and opinions and reviews on various comic books coming out today. Check that out as well. We thank you very, very much for your donations. I am setting up a Patreon page, so make it a little bit easier for other people to donate. I got some feedback on that. Patreon is in the works. I hope to get it up very, very, very soon. And that may encourage me, so to speak, to work out those last little technical glitches that are preventing me from getting a live broadcast show on Krypton Radio like I would like it. Speaking of other bonuses, other inclusions, other features for Slice of Sci-Fi, I'm going to encourage science fiction, fantasy, horror, radio dramas, radio plays to craft snippets. Not really promos, but actual segments from their audio dramas that they'd like other people to hear. Make it 2 or 3 minutes long, something that's easy enough to include in the show here. Same for nerd rock, geek music, indie bands playing geek music. If you have a song, send it my way. We'll see about getting it on the show. But that will do it for this episode. We will be back with more Slice of Sci-Fi next week. Take care.